Chapter 78. The airfield at Lac Saint Joseph, deep in the hills northeast of Quebec City, was one of several belonging to the Royal Canadian Air Force that had been shut down because of budget cuts. Its 2-mile runway was off limits to commercial aircraft, but was still used by the military for training and emergency landings. Henri Vion's plane stood in front of a weathered metal hangar. A fuel truck was parked beside it, and 2 men in raincoats were making a pre-flight check. Inside, in an office bare of furniture except for a rusting metal workbench, Charles Servais and Commissioner Finn stood in silence and watched the proceedings through a dirty window. The earlier drizzle had turned into a driving rain that leaked through the roof of the hangar in a dozen places. Fosgly was stretched out comfortably on a blanket. His hands were clasped behind his head, and he was oblivious to the water that splashed beside him on the cement floor. There was an air of smugness about him, of complacency almost, as he gazed up at the metal-beamed ceiling. The Vion disguise was gone, and he was himself again. Outside, the pilot jumped from the wing to the ground and dog-trotted to the hangar. He poked his head in the office door. "Ready when you are," he announced. Gly came to a sitting position. "What did you find?" "Nothing. We inspected every system, every square inch, even the quality of the gas and oil. Nobody's tampered with it. It's clean." "Okay, start up the engines." The pilot nodded and ducked back into the rain. "Well, gentlemen," said Gly, "I guess I'll be on my way." Servais silently nodded to Commissioner Finn. The Mountie set 2 large suitcases on the workbench and opened them. $30 million well-worn Canadian dollars," said Finn, his face deadpan. Gly pulled a jeweler's eyepiece from his pocket and began studying a random sampling of bills. After nearly 10 minutes, he repocketed the eyepiece and closed the suitcases. "You weren't joking when you said well-worn. Most of these bills are so wallet-battered you can hardly read the denominations." "As per your instructions," Finn said testily. "It was no simple matter scraping up that much used currency on such short notice. I think you'll find them all negotiable." Gly walked over to Servais and held out his hand. "Nice doing business with you, Prime Minister." Servais rebuffed Gly's gesture. "I'm only happy we caught on to your imposter scheme in time." Gly shrugged and withdrew his empty hand. "Who's to say? I might have made a damned good president. Maybe better than Vion." "Pure luck on my part that you didn't," said Servais. "If Commissioner Finn hadn't known Henri's exact whereabouts when you brazenly walked into my office, you might never have been apprehended. As it is, my sad regret is that I can't have your neck stretched on the gallows." "A good reason why I keep records for insurance," Gly said contemptuously. "A chronological journal of my actions on behalf of the Free Quebec Society, tape recordings of my conversations with Vion, videotapes of your wife in wild postures with your Minister of Internal Affairs. The stuff major scandals are made of. I'd say that's a fair exchange for my life." "When will I get them?" Servais demanded. "I'll send you directions to their hiding place after I'm safely out of your reach." "What assurances do I have? How can I trust you not to keep blackmailing me?" Gly grinned fiendishly. "None. None at all." "Your filth," Servais hissed angrily, "the excretion of the earth." "Are you any better?" Gly snapped back. "You stood mute in all your sanctity and watched while I wasted your political rival and your cheating wife. And then you had the gall to pay for the job with government funds. You stink even worse than I do, Servais. The best of the bargain was yours. So save your insults and sermons for the mirror." Servais trembled, the rage seething inside him. "I think you better get out. Get out of Canada." "Gladly." Servais got a mental hold on himself. "Goodbye, Mr. Gly. Perhaps we'll meet in hell." "We already have," grunted Gly. He snapped the suitcases shut, carried them outside, and entered the airplane. As the pilot taxied to the end of the runway, he relaxed in the main cabin and poured himself a drink. Not bad, he thought. $30 million and a jet airplane. Nothing like making an exit in style. The phone on the bar buzzed, and he picked it up. It was the pilot. We're ready for takeoff. Would you care to give me flight instructions now? Head due south for the United States. Stay low to avoid radar. 100 miles over the border, come to cruising altitude and set a course for Montserrat. Never heard of it. One of the Leeward Islands in the Lesser Antilles, southeast of Puerto Rico. Wake me when we get there. Sweet dreams, boss. Gly slumped in his seat, not bothering to fasten the safety belt. At that moment, he felt immortal. He grinned to himself as he gazed through the cabin window at the two figures silhouetted against the lights of the hangar. Sarva was a fool, he thought. If he had been in the Prime Minister's shoes, he would have hidden a bomb in the plane, rigged it to crash, or perhaps ordered the Air Force to shoot it down. The latter was still a possibility, though a slim one. But there was no bomb, and all the flight controls checked out from nose to tail. He had done it. He was home free. As the aircraft picked up speed and disappeared into the rainy night, Sarva turned to Finn. How will it happen? The automatic pilot. Once it's engaged, the plane will begin a very gradual climb. The altimeters have been set to register no higher than 11,000 feet. The pressurization system and the emergency oxygen will not come on. By the time the pilot realizes something is wrong, it will be too late. Can't he disengage the autopilot? Finn shook his head. The circuitry has been reset. He could beat the unit with an axe, but it would do no good. It is impossible for him to regain control of the aircraft. So they lose consciousness from loss of oxygen. And eventually come down in the ocean when they run out of fuel. They could crash on land. A calculated gamble, Finn explained. Figuring the plane's range on full fuel tanks and assuming Gly intends to fly as far away as possible before landing, it's 8-1 they hit water. Sarva looked pensive for a moment. The press releases, he asked. Written and waiting to be handed to the wire services. Commissioner Finn raised an umbrella, and they began walking to the Prime Minister's limousine. Puddles were forming in the low spots of the taxi strip. One of Finn's men turned off the lights to the hangar and runway. At the car, Sarva paused and looked up into the ebony sky as the last hum of the jet engines melted into the rain. Too bad Gly will never know how he was outsmarted. I think he would have appreciated that. The next morning, the following story ran on the International Wire Services. Ottawa, 6:10, special. A plane carrying Daniel Sarva and Henri Villon crashed in the Atlantic Ocean this morning 200 miles northeast of Cayenne, French Guiana. The wife of Canada's Prime Minister and the presidential candidate for newly independent Quebec took off from Ottawa for a flight to Quebec City last night, and when they failed to make their scheduled landing, the alert was given. Villon was piloting his own plane, and Madame Sarva was the only passenger on board. All radio contact went unanswered. Because Canadian air controllers did not immediately suspect the twin jet Albatross had flown into the United States, hours were lost on a fruitless search between Quebec and Ottawa. Not until an Air France Concorde reported an aircraft flying erratically south of Bermuda at 55,000 feet, 8,000 feet above the maximum altitude for which Villon's Albatross was certified, did anyone begin to make a connection. U.S. Navy jets were scrambled from the carrier Kitty Hawk near Cuba. Lieutenant Arthur Hancock was the first to spot the Albatross and reported seeing a man motionless at the controls. He followed until the plane went into a slow spiral dive and plunged into the ocean. We have no firm grasp on the cause, Ian Stone, a spokesman for Canadian Air Authority, said. The only theory that makes any sort of sense is that Madame Sarva and Mr. Villon became unconscious from lack of oxygen, and that the plane, on autopilot, had flown itself over 3,000 miles off course before running out of fuel and crashing. A search revealed no sign of wreckage. Prime Minister Charles Sarva remained in seclusion during the ordeal and had no comment.